From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we look at the formidable influence of money from both the Cuban exile community and major U.S. corporations on U.S. policy towards Cuba. Then a first-hand look at what's happening on the island. And the number of black farmers is declining at a rate three times that of white farmers. We look at allegations of discrimination against the U.S. Department of Agriculture. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A newly released CIA training manual describes torture methods similar to ones used on Honduran dissidents during the 1980s. The booklet, Human Resource Exploitation Training Manual 1983, was declassified on Friday in response to a Freedom of Information Act request from the Baltimore Sun. It advises interrogators to deprive their prisoners of food and sleep and make them stand at attention for long periods of time. The CIA said last month it has revived a probe into whether its officers failed to report allegations of torture by Battalion 316, a CIA-trained Honduran military intelligence unit, which has been blamed for the disappearance of 184 suspected rebels. The newspaper said the 1983 manual methods used by Battalion 316 show unmistakable similarities. In the 1980s, Honduras was a key player in the Reagan administration's attempts to overthrow the Sandinista government in neighboring Nicaragua and defeat an insurgency in El Salvador. Documents show political donations appear timed to White House functions. Comparison of Democratic Party data released on Friday with Federal Election Commission records shows at least 30 instances in which President Clinton's guests wrote large checks just before or after their visits. Democrats deny the president hosted fundraising events at the White House, which would in most cases be illegal, or that invitations to have coffee with Clinton came with solicitations for donations. A top Senate Republican is chastising House Speaker Gingrich for telling audiences in his home state of Georgia Saturday that he was the victim of an ethical double standard and bias against conservatives. Senator McCain said Gingrich's complaints about the reprimand and fine he received for ethics violations would only prolong the controversy. Chechens vote today for president and parliament in an election that is expected to cement their de facto independence from Russia after defeating Moscow's military in a 21-month war. And AIDS deaths in New York fell 30% in 1996, the first significant drop since reporting began in 1983. This according to research presented at an AIDS conference that ended yesterday. Other papers presented at the meeting bolstered early signs of new drug therapies' effectiveness, but also pointed out limitations. The FDIC is ready to settle a negligence case involving an Illinois SNL whose board included Congressmember Henry Hyde, people familiar with the case are saying to the Wall Street Journal. But the $850,000 proposed settlement, they say, doesn't mention any dollar figure for which the Republican Judiciary Panel chair is liable, as it does with 11 other ex-directors. South Korean workers rallied against a new labor law in Seoul and 13 other cities. Meanwhile, President Kim Il-sung ordered an investigation into Hanbo Steel's bankruptcy filing last week. Opposition leaders are charging that there were irregularities in large government loans to the company. Albanian riot police are battling about 35,000 protesters at a rally in Tirana demanding government compensation for losses suffered in the collapse of a pyramid investment scheme. And Tupac Amaru guerrillas released a Peruvian police general for health reasons, leaving 72 hostages at the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima. A Red Cross official who's been appointed a mediator and planned talks with the government said he saw signs the crisis may end peacefully. And back here in the United States and other labor news, about 4,300 workers at a General Motors truck assembly plant in Ohio walked off the job after refusing to accept a tentative three-year contract. Members of the International Union of Electrical Workers have voted against the agreement and went on strike at midnight on Saturday. The plant assembles the Chevrolet Blazer, GMC Jimny, and Oldsmobile Bravada sport utility vehicles. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Last year, President Clinton and Congress passed into law the Helms-Burton Act, a law designed to radically tighten the embargo against the government of President Fidel Castro. And this past week, the Washington, D.C.-based watch group, the Center for Public Integrity, released the results of an exhaustive year-long study into how money has helped fashion the controversial Helms-Burton Act. Today, we look at the moneyed forces from both the Cuban exile community and major U.S. corporations that shape U.S. policy towards Cuba. Joining us is Bill Hogan. He's the Director of Investigative Projects at the Center for Public Integrity. Let's talk about your report. The Center for Public Integrity has put out on the U.S.-Cuba connection called Squeeze Play, the United States-Cuba and the Helms-Burton Act. Can you tell us what it is that you found in this year-long study?
Well, I think the primary finding was that money and power have really shaped U.S. foreign policy. And we added up all the money that was spent by interests with a traceable stake in U.S.-Cuba relations. We found a total of $4.4 million contributed to congressional and presidential campaigns and the national political party since 1979. And that almost three-quarters of that came from the Cuban-American exile hardliner community. This is primarily trustees and directors of the Cuban-American National Foundation.
Can you talk about what it is that you understand they expected for those contributions?
Well, I look at it, I guess, a different way, and then we called it a foreign policy hat trick. They had three major goals in this period and got all of them. The first was the establishment of Radio Martí and then later Television Martí. The second was the passage of the Cuban Democracy Act in 1992. And the third was the passage last year, as you mentioned in the introduction, of the Helms-Burton Act.
And what clear documentation do you have of making their requests to Congress, to the president, of these demands?
Well, I think they've been very open about it. I mean, I think, you know, the controversy last week surprised me a little bit because basically all we said how successful they'd been. And we traced some of the money going to members of Congress, among them Senator Helms, who was a co-sponsor, obviously, of the Helms-Burton Act, and also Senator Robert Torricelli of New Jersey, who about 6 years ago really changed his position on this issue.
Can you talk about Senator Robert Torricelli's response, the New Jersey senator, to your report?
Well, I don't. The response of his office, I guess, I would characterize as almost vitriolic. I mean, they called us racist, basically, for having issued this report, and we asked them on Friday for a retraction of that word. We said basically, call the report what you will, but to brand us as racist for issuing is really out of line, which it is. I mean, it's very, I think, balanced and dispassionate report about the influence of money on politics.
Overall, how much money are we talking about?
Well, what we did, a very, very conservative estimate, again, was $4.4 million. And if you really add in some of the business interests that are hard to separate from Cuba specifically, it could be a lot more than that. But we, as I say, we took the most conservative route and stuck to contributions from individuals and companies with really a direct and traceable stake in Cuba.
And Bill Hogan, can you explain what U.S. multinationals have to gain by the Helms-Burton Act?
Well, sure. There are two sides of this issue. One would be the companies that had property there at the time it was seized in the revolution. And some of those companies have an interest in having their claims, which were established by a settlement commission in the 1970s, paid. Others have just an interest to go back in there and do business now, and they are far less interested in either getting money back from property that they owned then or penalizing the regime that's there now. And there are many hotel and resort companies, for example, that say they would like to go back in, but they obviously can't while Helms-Burton is in place.
Can you talk a little about who Jorge Mascanosa is and how he fits in to this whole money picture?
Well, he is the leader of the Cuban American National Foundation and is generally regarded as the most potent voice on Cuba-America relations. We saw last year virtually every major presidential candidate make a pilgrimage to Miami to speak before audiences composed of him and members of the Cuban American National Foundation. And he was the strongest lobbying hand behind the establishment of radio and TV Martí, and has sat on an advisory board, which his original term was 3 years and subject to presidential reappointment. I think it's been 11 years now without a reappointment, but it's just assumed that he is in charge there. So he's a very powerful figure in this equation.
Can you explain the conflict of interest there of him sitting on these boards?
Well, I think as we heard anecdotally stories every time there is an event, say, involving the Cuban American National Foundation in the United States, they would be faced with do they cover it or do they not, and I think it just raises all kinds of questions of journalistic integrity, if you will.
So what do you hope to come out of this report?
Well, one, the thing that I hope for most is that more Americans would become involved and interested and involved in some of the issues here. Typically, public opinion polling has shown that a very small percentage of Americans really even care what's going on in Cuba. And there's an old saying that power abhors a vacuum, and I think what happened in this case, because there's a vacuum, because the American public doesn't feel strongly about it, it's left room for moneyed interests to come in and sway the policy or bend the policy-making equation. So most of all, I hope that people will read this report there are ones similar to it, and really educate themselves about what's happened in U.S.-Cuba relations and what the stakes are there and how these influences have shaped policy.
Jorge Mascanosa and his organization is not beyond engaging in violence, and that's certainly been a fear of people on the other side. Is it also a fear of the media reporting on the kind of power that he wields?
Well, one, I want to say I'm not sure about. There has been a lot of violence. Generally, these are very emotional issues, and understandably so, but I think it is a high-pitched, high-stakes issue for anyone to get involved in. And we certainly found out that last week. We're not used to being called names like that. And there's just a heightened level of sensitivity, I think, on the part of any journalist who would go into this.
Now, certainly a number of multinational corporations would benefit from the U.S. allowing, trade with Cuba. And there are many corporations that feted President Fidel Castro when he came to New York to the United Nations on the 50th anniversary of that body's celebration. I think hundreds of them dined with him and talked to him. So where do they fit in?
Well, there's no question about that. And where they fit in, they're frozen out now because of the Helms-Burton Act. And we see ourselves with some diplomatic problems, particularly in Canada. We can see exactly the type of companies that want to do business in Cuba and are doing business. And, companies in the United States are frozen out. In our report, we quoted Dwayne Andreas, the chairman of Archer Daniels Midland, who essentially said in his view this policy is ridiculous. And if anyone compares this to China, that has human rights problems also and many of these same issues, it is a little difficult to figure out why we have this policy, say, for Cuba and not for China.
I know.
Policy being of a trade embargo.
That's right. I know Madeleine Albright, when discussing this recently, said China is an economic power to contend with, and she simply said that Cuba is a pariah in the Western Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, certainly the United States government has made it that. I want to thank you very much, Bill Hogan, for joining us. And
okay.
If people want to get a hold of your report, mm-hmm. where can they call and also where can they go on the Internet?
Well, the internet, they can call. Our telephone number in Washington is area code 202-783-3900. And on the internet, if I have to stop here. http://www.essential.org/CPI, the CPI being for Center for Public Integrity.
And again, the phone number 202-783-3900, or the website address is essential.org/CPI. Bill Hogan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me this morning.
Bill Hogan is the Director of Investigative Projects at the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Public Integrity. Their report, by the way, on Cuba is called Squeeze Play, the United States, Cuba, and the Helms-Burton Act. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. And continuing on the issue of Cuba, we're going to go right down to Cuba now. As Madeleine Albright takes over the post of Secretary of State, the question of Cuba will likely remain at the top of the U.S. foreign policy agenda, as well as a major issue in international forums like the United Nations. Joining us now to talk about Cuba, the UN, and U.S. foreign policy, as well as the economy of Cuba right now and how it's dealing with the Helms-Burton Act, is Phyllis Bennis. She's a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, that's also based in Washington, D.C., and she's just returned from a trip to Cuba, to Havana, and also to the countryside. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Thanks very much, Amy.
Well, you just came back right before the Canadian Prime Minister went down to Cuba, and the Canadian Foreign Minister went down to Cuba, dined with Fidel Castro, and I think really reaffirmed the relationship between Canada and the United States. I mean, Canada and Cuba.
Well, it's actually an interesting slip. I think our planes must have probably crossed each other somewhere over Miami, perhaps. But the visit of the Canadian Foreign Minister was a very, very crucial one. This was the highest-ranking Canadian official to come to Cuba since 1974. And the decision to come right at this time, when it was clearly seen as a slap in the face to the Helms-Burton Bill and to the U.S., was an expression, I think, not only of Canada's general intense opposition to Helms-Burton. There's been tremendous resentment, both at the government and popular level in Canada, over the question of U.S. interference in Canadian foreign affairs and commercial affairs, but also the willingness of Canada to state very clearly that despite the political or economic price that the U.S. was imposing on Canada, its largest trade partner, that Canada had no intention of bowing down to that pressure and stopping its trade with Cuba, that it intended to maintain its both commercial and political ties with the island. The tourism, for example, the Canadians make up the largest component of tourists traveling to Cuba every year, and Cuba these days is inundated with European and Canadian tourists. They're coming in the tens of thousands to enjoy the beaches and scuba diving and all of that. And the largest single component are from Canada. So I think that this is a real statement of the failure of the Helms-Burton Bill, as we heard just yesterday from former President Jimmy Carter, who spoke of why Helms-Burton would never work.
talk a little about that. It may have come to a surprise, as a surprise to many, that the former president of the United States was blasting the current administration, which does happen to be Democrat, his own party, in relation to the Helms-Burton Act.
Well, I think some of this has to do with Jimmy Carter's own political trajectory since leaving the presidency. He has become much more open-minded in foreign affairs as an ex-president than he ever was as president. I think that he has recognized through his role at the Carter Center of traveling around the world and negotiating in areas where U.S. diplomacy has failed, places like the Sudan, North Korea, other places, in what the U.S. deems pariah states, Carter has found a great deal of success in carrying out various rather delicate diplomatic missions, sometimes at the behest of the White House or the State Department, other times as more of a lone cowboy, if you will, although obviously with the surreptitious support of Washington in those instances. And I think in that context, he has recognized that there is obviously a possibility for easy negotiations with Cuba. What he didn't say, because as you say, Amy, he is from the same party as President Clinton, is that the attacks by the U.S. against Cuba, the political and the economic attacks, are rooted far more in U.S. domestic politics. And as we just heard, the question of the influence and money of the anti-Castro Cuban lobby based in Miami and New Jersey, that's the baseline reason that the U.S. has maintained its antagonism towards Cuba. It's not a fear of terrorism. It's not a fear of expanding communism. It's not nervousness about the Soviet Union. It's not any of those things. It's political, domestic, electoral politics. And it's for that reason that the Clinton administration has gotten itself into the pickle it now faces by, through the Helms-Burton bill, which, among other things, one of the not so often mentioned parts of that bill is to strip the U.S. presidency, strip the White House of the ability to make foreign policy decisions. Specifically, before Helms-Burton was passed last year, the embargo against Cuba was itself a presidential directive. It was something that could be lifted whenever the U.S. president made the decision that it was in the U.S. interest to do so. Under Helms-Burton, the embargo is now an act of Congress. So whatever Clinton may decide later that history requires or his second term requires or whatever to end the ridiculous antagonism towards Cuba, he no longer has the power to do that. He has conceded that power to Congress. And that's probably a very dangerous precedent, among other things, for future presidents.
You know, back on the Helms-Burton Act, in retaliation, the Cuban legislature on December 25th passed the Law of Reaffirmation of Cuban Dignity and Sovereignty, which allows Cubans through special courts to sue the U.S. if they've been, quote, victims of physical harm or property damage caused by action supported by the United States, including murder, injury, and economic damage suffered under torturers and assassins of the Batista dictatorship or criminals in the pay of North American imperialism. That a quote from this law.
Well, you know, part of that law, the part that you referred to, Amy, is primarily symbolic. It's a statement of the Cuban parliament that we will not allow Helms-Burton to go unanswered. But there's one part of it that is not only symbolic, and that is the part that says that any company seeking damages under Helms-Burton in U.S. courts at a later point or in any other way is no longer eligible for compensation. The Cubans and the Americans have been engaged in debate and discussion and dialogue over the question of compensation. There is a compensation board. It moves slowly. There are problems with it. But nonetheless, there is a process underway for assuring compensation to U.S. companies whose properties were nationalized in the early years of the revolution. This law says that any company seeking damages under Helms-Burton is no longer eligible for the compensation that they would be able to get if, had they not sought Helms-Burton-based compensation. Mm. So that part is really far more than symbolic. It's quite important.
We're talking to Phyllis Bennis, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, and has just returned from a trip to Cuba. Phyllis, now let's just get a picture of what is happening right now in Cuba, both in Havana and in the countryside where you spent some time.
Well, you know, Amy, I was last in Cuba 2.5 years ago, and that was at the time of the worst conditions of what the Cubans call the special period, referring to the collapse of their trade partners, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the collapse of their trade relations with the socialist countries of Europe. That was at really the bottom of that economic collapse that had happened so suddenly. Cubans had been accustomed to a relatively high standard of living, not only in the signature areas of healthcare and education, which have traditionally and remain at the very highest levels throughout the hemisphere, competing with the U.S. They actually beat out the U.S. in some of the UN's statistics on certain aspects of daily life, including things like infant mortality, healthcare, education. Some of those things, they are just below the U.S. in one or two of those categories. They still manage to beat out U.S. statistics. But what we see now in Havana is that there have been significant improvements in the economy. The economy grew 7.8% last year, which is almost twice the average of Latin American growth, which was 3.5%. And that growth is very evident on the ground. The buses are terribly, terribly crowded, but they are back on the streets again. There are private cars on the streets again. You don't see this so much in the countryside. I spent several days out in Camagüey, which is a provincial capital, about 375 miles east of Havana. It's in a sugar and cattle-raising region. Much poorer. The roads are primarily dirt roads. The primary east-west highway across the island, which was under construction from the late 1980s, stops suddenly about 75 miles west of Camagüey when the money ran out. There was no more money to pave the highway, so it just ends at a certain point, and it goes back to a two-lane, poorly paved road. You don't see cars and buses very much in the countryside. You see an awful lot of horses and horse-drawn buggies and a lot of bicycles. The bicycles never took in Havana. The city's too big. The population is too sophisticated. People didn't want to bother with the bicycles, despite the efforts of the government when they imported 500,000 bicycles from China and began a huge campaign to encourage people to use them. They were used for a very brief period when there really was no alternative, but now you do see buses back on the streets again. But there is still a serious problem, a problem of lack of food. No one is starving. I don't think people are really even hungry anymore. But there is a tremendous problem of shortages of the kinds of food people want to eat. The government-guaranteed rations are simply not enough. Production is not yet high enough. A good deal of the economic growth over the last couple of years, I think, has come not only from the increase in tourism and foreign investment in tourism and nickel mining and biotechnology, but also in the small-scale Cuban-run indigenous capitalist enterprises that have been legalized over the last couple of years. The most active sector is the small restaurants, the so-called paladars, that have proliferated all over Havana, less so in the countryside, where there is a great deal of economic activity and people are making enormous profits. The government is working very hard and with a certain level of success so far at soaking up the dollars and extra pesos that are being generated there through high taxes and high fees that are imposed on the paladars, designed to do two things. One, to prevent the rise of a very rapidly created, very wealthy class with all of the resulting problems of a widening gap between rich and poor within Cuban society. Secondly, to get government access to that hard currency and to the additional pesos to use to pay off the hard currency foreign debt, which has skyrocketed over recent years as Cuba has been forced to take out loans at very high commercial rates. So although there's a tremendous amount of grousing and complaining by people who run the paladars about the high fees and high taxes that they have to pay, the goal of it so far seems to be working. You do not yet see the growth of an enormously wealthy class leaving behind the majority of Cubans, and you see the government slightly better able to both pay off its hard currency loans and, very importantly, to use some of that hard currency for international purchases of things like powdered milk, certain medicines that are then distributed to all sectors of Cuban society in a way that helps to reach certain egalitarian goals society-wide. Now, how long that process can continue is a very difficult one. And many Cubans will say, you know, very forthrightly, that they don't know what the future is going to look like. Right now, while the businesses, the private businesses, are small scale, they can be controlled simply by legislation, by imposing taxes and fees. As that process expands, that will be much more difficult, and the challenges will be much greater. But there is a sense within Cuban society of a much greater sense of optimism than I found 2.5 years ago. People complain constantly. This is not a complacent or beaten down population. People are grousing and complaining and demanding, but those demands and complaints have not, it seems, translated into anything remotely resembling a widespread opposition movement. There is a sense from people that they resent what the government is doing, but at bottom they understand why they're doing it. And the sense of involvement in a political project that has not yet been defeated has, I think, raised morale in a certain way as the isolation of Cuba has set in over these last several years.
Phyllis, could an opposition movement grow in Cuba? Could it openly flourish?
I don't think at this stage an open opposition movement that was calling for an end to the revolutionary project would be allowed to survive in any open way. Cuban democracy is relatively new. It's quite fragile. It is not as supple and inclusive as, for example, the democracies of the Western industrialized countries that have existed for 200 years or 250 years, if we look at France or Great Britain or the U.S. It is not that experienced. It is narrower. The old slogan of within the revolution everything, outside the revolution nothing, sounds a bit dated on a certain level, but is probably still the guiding position of government forces. There are people, as I said, who complain. A vast majority of the population, I would say, complains constantly about specific government policies, and there is certainly no effort to squelch that. On the other hand, organizations that emerge to challenge the legitimacy of the government or the overall trajectory of the revolutionary project, I think are not allowed to survive in a public way. On the other hand, you don't have the sense walking through the streets that this is a militarized, repressive society. There's very little presence on the street of either military or police officials. There is a level, I think, of self-censorship, both within the Cuban press, which is fairly dismal, actually, in terms of what it covers, not least because of the problems imposed by the U.S. embargo at preventing them from getting decent access to information on a world scale, but also within certain sectors of the population. But as I say, I did not have the sense, spending days walking through the streets, both in Havana and in Camagüey and in the countryside, that this was a seething population with a revolt just beneath the surface. This is not a population that is largely facing repression. They are complaining, they don't like it, they are angry, and they express that. But that hasn't translated to an opposition movement, I think, less because of government repression than because that's just not what people are looking to. They are not wanting to create a society like they see on television that exists in Miami. They don't want, certainly, to replicate the experiences of other countries in Latin America with the enormous gaps between rich and poor that have children begging on the sidewalks. You don't see that in Havana. There is a small-scale crime wave underway, which is mainly kids grabbing bags off of foreigners' shoulders, that sort of thing. But it just can't compare to the kind of desperation you see in so many Latin American capitals of people living on garbage dumps and what you see here in Washington, D.C., for that matter, or in New York City, of people living on sidewalks. You do see people waiting in long lines. You see kids whose school uniforms are pretty tattered these days because they're not free any longer. The parents have to buy new ones when they grow out of them, so they patch them instead. But you don't see people who are hungry living on the streets. You don't see people who don't have access to medical care. This is, in a sense, an old story in Cuba, but the accomplishment is it's still true. With all of these problems, you still have guaranteed health care. You still have guaranteed education for every child. And if anything, the social problems are resulting from the over-education of the population, where, for example, a nuclear physicist whose father I spent a long time talking to in Old Havana one day is now working as a taxi driver because he can make more money that way.
Phyllis,
sorry.
I just have to say that we have to wrap up. So.
Okay.
But I very much appreciate your description of your trip to Cuba that you've just returned from. We've been talking with Phyllis Bennis, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and she's just returned from Havana and the countryside of Cuba. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the countryside of the United States. We're going to be talking about farming, particularly African-American farmers, and why it is they're losing their land at such a rapid rate. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The number of black farmers in the United States has been declining at a rate three times that of white farmers. Many black farmers, as well as Native American and Latino farmers, are pointing the finger at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who they say discriminates against minority farmers, especially in the crucial area of loans. Recent protests by farmers have sparked a flurry of activity at the USDA. Secretary Dan Glickman has instituted a series of listening meetings with black farmers nationwide, temporarily blocking all foreclosures and creating a special civil rights task force to investigate claims of discrimination. And we just have this word that there's another opening at the USDA. Grant Buntrock, who is administrator of the Farm Service Agency, which gives out farm subsidies, has told his staff that he's leaving in April. The FSA, that's the Farm Service Agency, has come under attack for racial bias as black farmers complain that they have been discriminated against and that loan and foreclosure determinations were made on the basis of race. Joining us right now to talk about this issue are two people. John Boyd is a poultry farmer from Southern Virginia and president of the Black Farmers Association. The association led hundreds of farmers in a demonstration outside the White House this past December. And Calvin King joins us. He's the director of the Arkansas Land and Development Fund, a nonprofit group that was established in 1980 in response to black land loss. Calvin King just returned from a weekend meeting in Atlanta with the director of the USDA's Civil Rights Action Team that's examining charges of discrimination. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Amy.
Let's begin with John Boyd. Can you tell us about the Black Farmers Association that you formed and why it is you demonstrated in front of the White House?
Well, we actually formed this organization because of the problems we have been experiencing with the Farmers Service Agency and discrimination. As I began to travel throughout the South, I found that there was many farmers all across the nation that have been experiencing this type of discrimination, such as poor processing time. It takes 222 days to process a black loan and 60 days to process a white loan. They have been from anywhere from 875 on up to 2,000 active complaints in the Office of Civil Rights that have not received a response. Some of these things have been sitting there for 15 years. They have no intentions of settling these claims, and the reason we protested in front of the White House is because we want these things addressed and we want these discrimination complaints settled.
How many people did you have in front of the White House?
I would say anywhere from 150 to 200 people.
And is the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, acknowledging that there's racism there?
They acknowledge it every day. I was in a listening session last week right here in Washington, D.C., where Secretary Glickman listened to farmers from Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, who they explained their concern and the lack of participating in these federal programs that are supposed to be for everyone, not just the large white farmer, but for every farmer. And this is what I want to see happening. And since I formed this group, there's a lot of small white farmers that came to the table. I said, Mr. Boyd, we want to help you. We have been experiencing the same problems, but with this discrimination, unfair lending practices on top of this, I don't know how y'all stayed in business.
We also have Calvin King on the line, director of the Arkansas Land and Development Fund, speaking to us from Fargo, Arkansas. Mr. King, what do black farmers complain about to you in the eastern Arkansas-Mississippi Delta?
Well, pretty much for the same things that Mr. Boyd expressed, lack of timely processing of loans, lack of equal access, to financing, in comparison to, the Europeans as a whole, the white farmers. And also the timeline is for gaining access to that money once the applications have been submitted. Along with, a number of other areas, along with financing, you'll find there has not been equal access to programs that have been extended, through USDA that can enhance the overall survivability, farms, building farm capability. And what I call infrastructure development on those farms, building the soil capacity through cost share programs. Irrigation cost share is another area that you'll find that has not been equal or equitable distribution, of dollars in those areas. And you will find in other areas that have direct payment contribution to farmers from a program perspective, there's an imbalance, as well, from price support payments, where you don't have the same distribution of crop bases. Of course, there's that links back to some of the other problems incurred, in this whole process. If you don't have a rice base, then of course you can't participate in certain programs because you don't have the actual base established. Well, all the same time, the soil fertility that's necessary and irrigation is necessary also in doing rice production. So not being able to share an equitable basis on various programs in cost share and being provided the type of support assistance, on an equal basis as well, has shared tremendously in this problem we're faced with today.
Calvin King, what is the history surrounding the black land loss story? I mean, your group emerged in 1980 precisely to fight black land loss. I mean, that was 17 years ago.
Yes, well, the history itself, goes back, and that's everything from blatant thievery and blacks being run off their land to trickery in where people were actually, tricked out of the land, be it through different types of contract procedures that are executed where people just didn't realize, because of, one, where some of the education status was, during that time period. As well as not being supported, in a proper manner, by some of the support institutions that existed then in the federal system. Other areas you'll find is where there's been a lack of wills being left, where heir property came into being, where family members may have had the intentions of that land being transferred from one generation to the next, but because of laws that exist, from state to state. In most cases, you'll find that those laws will say that land cannot be divided equally and equitably. And if you go through the court process with petitions, into the courts to divide the property, the property is normally sold off at public auction. Well, again, you come back to access to financing. In those situations, normally you do not find where family members have been able to gain access to financing to buy all the other heirs out, be it through USDA or any other institution. And let me say this as a part of the record that while USDA has been the, and still remains, to be the main financing system, institution for African Americans in farming, that this does not just apply to USDA as far as financing is concerned. Because when you talk about financial institutions, an institution that's supposed to meet the Community Reinvestment Act, you find that the other financing institutions have not provided that access as well.
John?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead. What were you saying?
There's one thing I'd like to add to that. Right now, black farmers are less than 1% of the nation's farmers. 67% of that 1% is tied up with the Farm Service Agency, which means they play a tremendous role in our future. If we don't start participating in these federal programs like all the other farmers, by the year 2000, there will not be any active farmers. Yes, there's a lot of layout, what I call layout land, that means it's not being worked and it's family-owned, and there is trickery. But for the active farmers that are left, there are 67% that's tied with the federal government. So if something doesn't be done where we can participate in these federal programs, right now I'm working on what's called the Agriculture Reform Act of 1997, which I'm going to submit to Congress, which is going to put the small farmer, not just black farmer, but small farmer, being white, Hispanic, Mexican-American, back on the farm. And Mr. King, I would like to ask you to assist me with that.
I'll be more than happy to.
Thank you.
And what does this law do that enables you to, that will help black, Latino, and other farmers of color, and small farmers, white farmers, too?
Yes, it specifically asks Secretary Glickman for $20 million of his discretionary funds to be used to put the small farmer back on the farm. These farms that are in federal inventory, which means they've been taken from black farmers. We want the black farmer to retain access to this land. Mm-hmm. Why sell this land and just keep it in inventory? We're also not participating in what's called the 1951S Loan Servicing Program, which simply states for debt write-down,
John
loan
Boyd,
restructuring, things of this nature.
John Boyd, let me ask you something. Could the federal government argue that it's not that the government is being discriminatory or racist? It's that overall African Americans in the population tend to be poorer, and that's true with farmers also, and black farmers are losing their land because they're poorer.
Yes and no. When you have county supervisors, that's the credit manager for these local county offices throughout America, which makes remarks like all blacks are lazy and they want a paycheck every Friday, that he's not going to participate in outreach. There was 66 farmers in Brunswick County, Virginia, that was participating in this federal program. Today, there are only six. The other 60 have been foreclosed on. And it's because of the hate, racist attitude of a county supervisor like that. And that's how it's been affecting these farmers all across the country. Now, what happened here in Washington, D.C. was a can of worms was let open. Secretary Glickman has made a statement time and time again that racism, discrimination exist, and they deplore it. But what I want to see is an across-the-board settlement for all black farmers that have been discriminated against, for these 2,000 active complaints in the Department of Agriculture. We want these cases settled. Enough is enough.
What do you think of Grant Buntrock, the administrator of the Farm Service Agency, the FSA, leaving? Do you see this as a positive sign?
Yes, it's very positive. Mr. Buntrock knew for years that there was problems. I've talked to him several times, no changes. The foreclosure process is terrible for blacks. If they can get part of the debt written off and maintain a steady payment that they can stay on the farm, that would help them stay on the farm. Why take these rundown farms, put them in inventory, and the taxpayers have to pay taxes on when they have federal programs that they can participate in, loan restructuring, reamortization, debt write-down? All of these things should be offered to that farmer the same way they offer it to the large farmer out in California. every loan over $1 million, there's 88% delinquency rate. You want me to, farmers are delinquent, black, that have a million dollar loan balance? Not one.
Well, let me ask you both, John Boyd and Calvin King, if you have phone numbers that people can call if they want to support your organizing, or if they're farmers themselves and they want to get in touch with you. Calvin King.
Yes, if they want to get in contact with me, they can reach me at area code 501-734-1140.
That's 501-734-1140, and that's the number of the Arkansas Land and Development Fund in Fargo?
And Amy, that's Arkansas Land and Farm Development Corporation.
Uh-huh, okay. And John Boyd?
Yes, my number is 804-447-7825.
That's 804-447-7825.
Yes.
And what can we see as the next action that you will be taking? And basically, do you have any confidence in the Agriculture Secretary, Dan Gluckman?
When we demonstrated in front of the White House, he indicated that he was moved by the testimony of some of these farmers and had no idea that they was being mistreated this bad. He wasn't moved enough to settle some of these complaints. That part bothers me. So by April, if these cases are not settled, I'm going to ask all farmers to come out, not just black farmers, but all farmers that have been at the hands of USDA to come out, and we're going to protest until these cases are settled.
How long do you think there's going to be a moratorium on foreclosures, which is a good sign?
That is a good sign. But it only affects the farmer that has an active complaint in. So it leaves out a lot of farmers. I mean, my question to Secretary Gluckman is, what happened to all the farmers that were foreclosed on 10, 20 years ago that had an active complaint in the Office of Civil Rights? What happened to all those farmers? They lost their farms unfairly in that triangle that I call it, with the county supervisor, the fertilizer dealer, the tractor dealer, all coincide to get these farms for peanuts.
Amy, you know, one of the other things right now that's occurring, I think it's very good that there's a moratorium on as far as foreclosure is concerned. But the other is that a number of farmers that were able to take advantage of the 1951S, doing debt restructuring, debt write-down, along with having to file Chapter 12, you know, to get a court-ordered process of debt restructuring where they were involved with more than one financial institution, or that just was the direction they had to go because of the creditors that were involved. They do not have access to financing as far as operating loans are concerned, you know, as the Farm Bill now stands.
Well, Calvin King, we are going to have to break off discussion now, but we're going to continue to follow the story as it develops and follow the bill that John Boyd hopes to have introduced into the U.S. Congress. And I will add that if African Americans ever get reparations in this country, 40 acres and a mule, it's a good thing if that land is protected. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Our guests have been John Boyd, a poultry farmer from Southern Virginia, and Calvin King, director of the Arkansas Land and Farm Development Corporation. Julie Drizin is our executive producer, Ken Mason, our engineer in Washington, D.C. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Minutes, 15 seconds. Universal time, 14 hours, 59 minutes.